Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a return guest, someone who I was really happy to speak with before, and somebody whom I know who can give us insight into a lot of our economic issues that I think people don't really know a lot about. And ESG is something that's been talked about, but I think it's still a little bit of a black box. And so I wanted to have Dr. Sutter come back on. He's the Charles G. Koch Professor of Economics with the Manuel H. Johnson Center for Political Economy at Troy University. And he's a PhD graduate of George Mason University. His research has examined the societal impacts of extreme weather, the economics of the news media and media bias, the markets for economists and economic research, environmental regulation, and constitutional economics. He's published over 100 articles in scholarly journals in economics, atmospheric sciences, civil engineering, and political science, and he's also written or edited 4 books. He writes a weekly column on economics and public policy for yellowhammer.com and Alabama Today, and a monthly column on Alabama economics and policy for 1819 News. He's the host of Econiversations on Troy University's Trojan Vision television channel, a show examining economic and policy questions. He's also the policy advisor for the Heartland Institute. So Dr. Sutter, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, I want to thank you for letting me come on the show. I'm happy to come on and talk about this for you.
Thank you. And you wrote a wonderful article, and it was titled ESG, Regulations and Economic Freedom. And I really wanted to delve into this because it seems that ESG is taking over, basically, society. It seems like most of the decisions that are being made from a political, from a corporate standpoint, are being driven by this. So I wanted to start off the conversation by, what is ESG?
Okay, well, so let's start with the ESG, our initials, and they stand for environmental, social, and governance. And so it really is, in one way, an approach to investing. An approach to investing your money that's supposed to take into account more than just the profitability of the companies that you're investing in. You're supposed to be considering the broader societal impacts of these investments, how they affect the economy, most likely climate change, how they impact society, particularly the issues related to diversity and inclusion. And then also there's some issues related the governance of the corporation, some issues about how it is that a corporation should be structured. So, for instance, like who should be on a corporation's board of directors. This is a relatively new form of this, but the idea of like somehow what was previously a few decades ago called socially responsible investing actually goes back probably 40 or 50 years. There's long been an idea, at least amongst some people in terms of investing, that you should look at more than just the bottom line in investment. And in some of the earliest, what we would now think of as like socially responsible investments, were efforts to try to avoid companies that say were doing munitions work during the Vietnam War, or companies that were involved with the alcohol and tobacco or other type of sin industry. So it's a new manifestation of something that's been around for so many years. And most importantly, there's some regulatory issues that we could get into here.
I definitely want to get into them, but I want to start off by asking the question, is this voluntary? It's a double question. But since when does somebody get to decide who's on someone's corporate board? And Why would a corporation do this? What's the benefit to them?
Well, okay, so is it voluntary? There's two different ways in which ESG is coming out, or is being asserted in the marketplace. One of them is through what are called ESG investment funds that some investment firms, like say Vanguard, Fidelity, BlackRock, other investing companies, and some other financial institutions will offer. So what they're with these ESG funds, they're saying like, oh, we're going to put together this fund, but instead of say investing in energy or instead of investing it in like tech, we're going to pick out investments in companies that have very good ESG scores or very, very good ratings for ESG. Now, if investors are free to invest their money however they want, if you've earned money and saved it, it's your money to invest or not invest however you wish. And if you choose put your money into an investment fund that's going to, say, pursue ESG goals as opposed to, say, the best return possible, it's your money, that's your choice. So there is that part of it that would be voluntary. But then we get into some areas there that are far less voluntary than that.
So we're talking things like, for people who have their government or their local government's retirement funds, are those things also being invested so that the person that's in it doesn't really have a choice? They're just having to go along.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. So that's one of the areas where we get into where it's not obviously voluntary. So particularly state employee pension funds that they have chosen, some of these pension funds have chosen to invest their members' assets, their savings, in ESG funds. And so that's one of the biggest in the U.S. That's one of the biggest sources of dollars that are going into these ESG and investment funds. It's not just individual investors choosing to put their money in an ESG fund. It's these pension funds that choose to put their members' contributions into these ESG funds. Now, that's we could probably have an entire show just debating as to whether or not that's completely voluntary or not, because these pension funds do have to have people who the members elect to make the decisions about how they invest the money. But then those people who are elected to those positions are also have what the law recognizes as a fiduciary duty to invest that money in the most responsible way possible for their members. So that given the amount of risk, they're supposed to be trying to get the best return they can. They're not legally the people, even if they've been elected to, say, run their state pension program funds, they still have this fiduciary duty to invest their members' contributions in a way that's going to earn that's going to earn enough in the way of investment earnings to pay the members' promised benefits when they retire. And so that's an area where, like I said, there's a lot more of the money that in the U.S. that goes into ESG funds are from these pensions in this case, where it's some strong questions can be raised as to whether or not this is voluntary or not.
Well, if the fiduciary side of this, it makes me question things. So we keep hearing about these companies like Disney, for example, where their stock prices are dropping. Isn't that an example of maybe giving your money invested in something that is being hit by their choices? How can you divest from that? How can people, if I had a portfolio in there, I'd be really kind of concerned that their stock prices are dropping, but nobody's seeming to look out for my best interest. And it seems like they're cushioned from this. So you can make a bad decision or decision that goes against what the society is for, but nothing, there doesn't seem to be how can I put it? There's no harm, no foul. They just keep going down the same path, for example. So is there a cushion, I guess, to this that it doesn't matter what the people think or the investors think, we're just going to do us. So is there another source to cushion them?
Well, for state pensions, the problem turns up to be that most all the state pension programs, the promised benefits are guaranteed either by state law or by the state constitution. And so if there's insufficient funds in this pension program to pay the promised benefits, taxpayers of the state at some point in the future would be on the hook. They would have to make additional appropriations of tax dollars to the pension funds to bail them out. So, yeah, in one sense, you know, a state pension plan could be pursuing ESG investments and letting the people who run the pension plan feel very good about themselves because they're helping to save the world. But if they don't happen to save and invest enough to pay their members' future benefits, well, in theory, then state taxpayers are going to have to step in and pay that off. So, again, the people who are saving the world are using other people's money, and that's highly problematic.
My gosh, I didn't realize that. And that really, that's maddening, really. This seems to be a template that goes on and on. It's just like, reminds me, for Social Security, for example, that lockbox has been raided multiple times for other things, but now we're all going to be on the hook for paying more or waiting longer to access Social Security. So whatever choices these guys make, everybody else has to pay the price for it. And it just, how did this even get to this point that they could just play casino and then everybody else is going to pay for it no matter what?
Well, and certainly, you know, I think with the ESG, it goes, it's related to something called that the United Nations established about 15 years ago, called the Principles for Responsible Investing. And this was out of an initiative that was created with a document called Who Cares Wins. And so it's been the United Nations at one level very much pushing the idea that we need to transform business and finance into agents of social good to make the world a better place. And, you know, I personally find that very problematic because it suggests that business and finance as carried on normally doesn't make the world a better place. And that's absurd. Businesses make our lives better every day. If you just want to think of all the ways in which, you know, you might use Amazon. And, you know, and I certainly know I live in a small town in Alabama. Man, having Amazon has made my life so much better because I can go on there and order just about anything I want from around the world. And so, I mean, businesses, if they succeed in the marketplace and make a profit, have to be making the world a better place because every purchase by a consumer is a voluntary. The only reason somebody's going to buy something from Amazon or Walmart or any other company out there is because the product that they're offering that consumer judges to be better than the other things that are available. So business already makes the world a better place. Well, finance makes the world a better place too, because, you know, our banks are crucially important. And for one thing, because businesses run on credit, right? You can't operate a business in virtually most lines of business without credit, because, you know, you have to produce goods to sell, and you have to, you know, get you have to hire workers and get a factory or a warehouse and tools and raw materials to produce something, and then you hope you're going to be able to sell it. Well, you know, if you're not using exclusively your own funds to run this business, you're going to borrow. And so the banks play this important, huge role in financing business, and that makes the world a better place. And then, you know, financial institutions are also the means by which we invest in new ventures, new ventures that are going to end up making our lives better off. So the pursuit of profit, because, again, you know, you can only make profit, you know, a new business when they succeed and make a profit. They're only making that profit because they're making the world a better place. So I hate this this line that there are groups like the UN and the World Economic Forum have pushed to say somehow we have to transform business and finance and banking to serve the social good, because they already do.
Exactly. And they also promote economic freedom. And I want to go over that in more detail when we come back from our first break. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Daniel Sutter. And before the break, you did a wonderful job of really giving us a foundation for our conversation. You know, you just described before the break the power of economic freedom, the ability to open up your own, sell what you want, have people pay a fair price that they deem is value, you know, the appropriate value for the service, and how that allows everybody really to do what they want. I mean, this whole system seems to be a top-down, centralized, pick the winners, pick the losers type of system. And I wanted to discuss economic freedom in more detail. You just described really what to me capitalism is. It's about being able to do what you're big enough to do and what you're brave enough to do. How does ESG change that? And if it does, in what way does it steal our economic freedom?
Well, a lot of that's still sort of up in the air because, you know, it's not clear what exactly the form of ESG-related regulations are going to turn out to be. So, and that's part of the reason why a lot of people are trying to push back on this, because the future isn't cast in stone yet. And so, you know, we're trying to raise some objections about ESG before things are set in place and then become irretrievable. So, but prospectively, there certainly appears to be a great deal of fear that at some point we'll end up with some kind of ESG mandate from the government, from our governments. And these mandates could be of two different forms. One could be on the banks and financial services. So the way this would work is individual businesses get ESG scores. But there's lots of different agents, lots of different groups that try to come up with ESG scores right now. There's actually hundreds of different groups trying to score ESG factors for different businesses. But the idea being that individual businesses and countries can all get scores based on their activities, whether to what extent they meet the included environmental, social, and governance goals. And so then the fear would come that at one level, there might be attempts to require business corporations to maintain a minimum ESG score to continue to operate. Or alternatively, the regulation could take the form of requiring banks and other financial institutions to maintain a minimum ESG average score of all of the different companies they do business with, or perhaps prevent banks from doing business with companies who have too low of an ESG score, who fail to meet some minimum ESG score. Now, like I said, at this point, this is all sort of speculation. France is moving ahead with some mandatory ESG regulations at this point. So it's unclear exactly if for sure we're going to get these mandates, but it certainly appears to be the direction we're headed.
So that leads to the question of what are some of these parameters for environmental, social governance? What is that from a social standpoint? Because to me, it seems like they first tried to do this digital dollar, digital ID, and I can see people being on this grid where they control what you can buy or shut off your card if you don't follow what they want you to follow. It seems like this is, to me, backdoor, where they've used the corporate structure to kind of hide this so that in order for you to access the corporate structure, you have to, they want you to get, you know, herded down this gatekeeping system.
Yeah, I think you're right in that a digital central bank currency and ESG mandates could serve much of the same purposes, especially if either of them go in the more nasty Orwellian the control, the totalitarian control type direction. So the people who are fearing that ESG scores could become like social credit scores, or that they have in China. or that central bank digital currency could be allowed, that the government decide what you get to purchase and what you don't get to purchase. So there is a lot of overlap there. Some of these same extreme goals could be achieved through either purpose. But to get into some more concrete things in terms of ESG, with the E part, and like I said, there's hundreds of different groups trying to come up with ESG ratings, and they measure different things specifically with different weights and so forth. But most of the time with the environmental part, it has something to do with a company's environmental or carbon footprint, or tracking carbon emissions from a company. So attempting to move to be net zero or reducing carbon emissions is usually one of the things that they have there on the environmental standpoint. For the social part, they can have a number of different things. One thing that a number of different ESG ratings rely on is the company scores that are given by this group called the Human Rights Campaign, which traditionally has pushed gay rights in many different forms. They were long advocates of gay marriage, and so their corporate equality, they have what they call a corporate equality index, and that gets used as input on the S side in a lot of ESG measures. And then the last thing might be is with governance issues. You might look at the composition of a company's board of directors and look and see, do they have equal number of men and women on that board, or do they have minorities represented on their board of directors? And you give them a higher score if they do and a lower score if they don't.
You know, this is so interesting because when you look at this structure, it really is hardwiring the inequality, if you really want to think about it that way. I mean, who ends up on these boards? It's the moneyed, the people who are friends of, the people who've gone to the elite schools. We're not talking about people coming off the street being allowed to enter into this hallowed society. It's the same people, but now they've made it, mm-hmm. they've structured it in such a way that it's hardwired. How do you get in when you've got a great idea and you're a savvy person? If you don't come from the right pedigree, if you don't have the right friends, you're not getting in the system. People not understand that.
Yeah, that's certainly that is certainly an issue, and that and I think that's some of what the fear is, that especially amongst financial institutions, like big financial institutions will be able to do ESG fairly easily, but a small financial institution might struggle. A well-established big corporation is surely going to be able to do some stuff to get a better ESG score, but a company that's just starting out could have a very hard time. And one of the areas very specifically where this comes up is what's known, there's three different, in terms of, for the E part with carbon emissions, in terms of carbon disclosures, there's the three different categories that a company, that they would like a company to track. And one would be their own emissions, and then it would be the upstream, some of them that are from the resources that they use. So if you purchase coal or whatever, or wood or whatever, whether that those resources you're purchasing are being sustainably sourced or environmentally sourced. And, but then the third thing would be the downstream users, any of your suppliers, any of the companies that then sell you anything. And that's where it becomes very, very problematic, because this third category would impact a lot of small businesses that have no ability to measure their own carbon footprint. And so that's one case where you could really sort of see this if they wanted to take it that way. Big companies would only be able to do business with other big companies, because these smaller companies wouldn't be able to measure their own carbon footprint adequately. So there are some ways in which which ESG could really be turned to create some huge barriers to entry and lock people out of trying to get in on our economic system.
Wow. Well, they talk about inclusion, right? It's actually not inclusive in at all from what you just described.
Exactly.
So this really smacks to me of what happened during COVID, where there were essential businesses and there were non-essential. It seemed that everybody who was small mom and pop became not essential. And the big ones were allowed to do what they wanted to. And they ended up taking more market share. And it seems to me this may be a bigger picture where it's designed to do what you just described. Get rid of the competition, be the biggest game in town, be the only place that people can go and shop or bank or eat at or whatever you want to put it, where it locks people into a two-tier system. Is that one way to think about it?
It could be. Although, again, you know, fortunately, you know, nothing I think is written in stone yet with ESG. And so it's not clear that these dystopian elements of it will ever come forward in regulation. And hopefully, if people start pushing back on it, they won't. But yeah, there certainly could be the same thing. And, you know, I think with COVID, it was such a disgrace that we had our governments trying to classify some businesses as non-essential, because I mean, it's just so insulting to the people for whom those businesses are their dream, their life dream is, you know, and they've invested so much of their time and fortune trying to build a business. And then like government bureaucrats, because it's like, oh, that's non-essential. And like, they don't really have any real basis for that. And so, you know, as you said, similar big retailers stayed open selling the exact same stuff, but they closed the small stores as non-essential.
It's very sad, but it seems that we need to really have a bigger idea instead of using, it seems all driven by language and rhetoric and social, I should say emotional blackmail, right? If you really want to stand up for yourself, somehow you're anti-human or you want people to die. I mean, they're really, this the rhetoric is all about shutting people up. And worse yet, having this grid come at you where it basically shuts you up because you can't speak. You know, you're off of social media, you get, you know, demonized, people stop going to your facility or whatever. But it seems to have a very social punitive side to it.
It definitely can. And, you know, I mean, another threat for businesses is that the businesses can, we have seen examples of businesses getting debanked, what's called debanked, that the bank that they've done business with for years and years just informs them that we're no longer going to do business with you. And, you know, because it's related to somehow that this business is going to have a low ESG score and might adversely affect the bank's ESG score. So they're, even though it's not official yet, they're cutting ties with businesses that are likely to have bad ESG scores, could lower their ESG score. And, you know, and since banks, since all businesses are basically on credit, well, you get cut off from the banking sector if you can't find another bank to take your business in. You know, that business is going to fail because, I mean, you have to be connected to the banking system to run a business, especially if you've already got loans out and everything. So again, that's just another element of this that reminiscent of COVID, and certainly could be setting thing to simply turn off the credit for non-essential or disfavored or not sustainable businesses.
That's a really very important point. Let's take our second break because I want to segue that. We talked about the economic side. Now we got to talk, I think, also about the religious side of this. So let's take our first break. I'm sorry, our second break. Sorry. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter, and you can go to his television show, is it not? The Econoversations?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, people need to go there. It's Trojan Vision Television Channel. And before the break, we were talking about the economic side. What about the religious side? I mean, there seems to be, to be honest, a war on religion and war on God. So at this point, do you foresee this really expanding into getting into what our spiritual choices are? If we don't go along, if we don't kowtow to the science side of this, will that also be a way that people can be locked out of the system?
I mean, conceivably, and especially with the social part of it, and if you're going to include things like abortion rights or protection, or if you're going to get a low S score, if you are perceived as homophobic or transphobic, you definitely could have some areas there that could spill over into religion, and the people with different religious views are being affected there. So, you know, especially with this corporate equality index that comes from the Human Rights Campaign, you know, if they want to score down your company, then it can really have a big impact in terms of your ESG score overall, and then therefore access to credit. Now, to this point, it's largely been, I think the Human Rights Campaign only scores like big corporations. So it's not like an issue in this regard. But again, you could see though that is one potential path going down in the future where some of this could show up.
So from the standpoint of the companies, you've just made a demarcation between those that are not publicly traded and not big corporate entities. I mean, these guys are huge. Did they really need to go with this ESG system? Is it because they really don't want the competition, and because I don't think they have a soul in terms of they really care about any of the things that they're purporting. I mean, you know, it reminds me of the Bud Light controversy. They could care less. They threw this guy under the bus as soon as they could because they were losing market share. So why do they really need this? They have business. They make buku money. Why do they need to go down this pathway of ESG? Is it another source of revenue for them?
It could well be. And like, again, I won't pretend to say that I know exactly what these companies are thinking when they do it. But if you look at like the big financial institutions, the companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, some of these big companies that have set up ESG funds, one of the things to note is that they charge much higher fees to the investors in an ESG fund than a non-ESG fund. And you know, we know, because we've seen some financial institutions take an underperforming fund that wasn't attracting much money and, you know, not generating a lot of the way of fees for the company, and they rebranded as an ESG fund, and now they tap into this, so they get a lot more money coming into it because it's an ESG fund. And typically the fees that they charge investors are about three times higher. And so, yeah, a part of this could be simply a way for some of these big financial companies to earn more in the way of fees, because and it is really sort of problematic, because in at least one case, I know some analysts have gone in and looked at this company's ESG index, and it's sort of like 99% correlates with the Standard & Poor 500. And yet they're charging triple the fees what they would if you just invested in an S&P 500 fund. So you know, there's clearly some games going on here to try to get investors to pay higher fees. So yeah, that's going to increase some profits, and that's for sure. But then there's other ways in which it's not clear they're necessarily making a lot more money, and that becomes a little more problematic, because you know, certainly like BlackRock and Larry Fink, who runs BlackRock, has gotten a lot of attention for this. But well, one of the ways in which they're advancing ESG is not just with their ESG targeted funds, but they claim to be using a corporate wide commitment to ESG. And so they have funds that are not ESG targeted, but then they will vote the shares that they hold in these S&P 500 accounts. They will vote these shares to support ESG related propositions that are put up at the stock among the stockholders. These are, in effect, ballot propositions that small left-wing progressive groups put forward And then they would normally have no chance to pass. But, you know, BlackRock and others perceive that they are advancing some ESG or progressive causes. And so they vote all these shares in their passive index funds to support that. So that's another way in which they're helping support this. And how exactly they're making money from that is less apparent. But I understand that I can understand the charging triple the fee for the same fund part of it. I'm not completely clear how they're going to make money, but they're also smart enough to know that I'm going to guess they've figured out some way they're going to make money from this other stuff too.
I have one question that may be the link to this. Is there any connection between this this ESG grid and the WEF, the World Economic Forum? Is there any connection between what we already know, what they've already espoused, which is to have everybody be basically own nothing and like it? Is this part of that? Is it anywhere connected to that?
There's certainly a lot of overlap. The World Economic Forum is also independently a big proponent of ESG as well. And so, I mean, I think if you look at internationally, it's been the United Nations and the World Economic Forum that have been by far the biggest proponents of things like ESG. And before that, Principles for Responsible Investing. And then also there's like the Global Compact for Business that they have. So there's certainly a lot of overlap. A lot of it is sort of like, if you want to think about it, the same kind of elites. If you want to refer to them this way, the global elites. That there's a lot of overlap, and you see the conferences that they put together. It's usually also often going to be the UN Global Compact plus the World Economic Forum as two of the two major sponsors. So there's certainly a lot of overlap. Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum have for years been advancing this idea of, as he was like socially responsible investment and socially responsible capitalism, a new form of capitalism, and then more recently what they've called the Great Reset. They've certainly been advancing that as well. So I guess they're both sort of players in this area.
So again, contradiction of the rhetoric versus the reality of what could possibly create. It's just staggering, really, because we're talking about a system where you can't speak your mind. You can't really be who you are if it perceived to go against another group. And then they get to decide the winners and the losers because not all groups are represented. So if it's only supposed to be for the advancement of a certain segment of the world, society, how is that really diversity? And how is that fairness? I mean, that to me is the opposite of what the rhetoric states.
Yeah, and definitely, you know, if you're one of the people who get invited to these big worldwide gatherings, then yeah, you might be able to have a voice to some extent on this. But yeah, that itself is pretty exclusive, not inclusive. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and then beyond that, when they formulate what they want, they basically, I think, want the rest of us to just listen, you know, shut up, listen to them, and do as what they're commanding.
It's really funny how it's not funny, actually. I mean, in a weird way, how this is all unfolding. It's based on the goodness of people, on people wanting to be fair, on people wanting to think of the greater good, but it's actually not the greater good of humanity. It seems to be about the greater good of the people who are in positions of power to manipulate the system and to really work off the backs of everybody else and have them not be able to complain or stand up without being penalized in some way.
Yeah, I think that's completely correct. That's completely on the mark. And, you know, there are always people who want to go out and save the world. And I think, John Kerry, climate czar, was at the World Economic Forum this last time it met in Davos and had a line. I was like remarking about of the people sitting around there is, imagine just how amazing this is. Here we are. We're like saving the planet. And, you know, there are people with some really big egos and they want to feel like they're going to do these really great things. But it's really also a mechanism to take other people's money and use other people's money to save the planet in according to your own vision of how to save the planet, which, you know, like, not everybody's going to agree with your formula for saving the planet, and not everyone's going to want to live in that what you think is going to be this paradise, and you know you're looking to take other people's money and use it to form a fashion to save the world in the way that you wish to save the world.
Well, I think you can go further, save the world so you benefit in perpetuity, if you really want to go there. On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter. And again, you can go to his column on economics and public policy at yellowhammer.com and Alabama Today, where he writes a monthly column on Alabama economics and policy for 1819 News. You know, we talked a lot about the social side, the economic side. What about the political side? I think in the United States, we're seeing a lot of, how can I put it, vindictiveness. And people who are on the other side of the coin are being denigrated and being persecuted. Is that something that this ESG is really creating, a one system, a one party system, where if you're outside of the in-group, you're going to be somehow removed in a punitive way?
Could be true. And I think, you know, because one thing we can definitely look at, if you go back, ESG really took off in like 2017, and that was when President Trump withdrew the United States from the Paris Climate Accords. And I think there's pretty good evidence to show that, you know, a lot of people looked at this and said, oh my gosh, we may not be able to count on the U.S. government to force companies to do what we want them to do. We need to have some other means of control, because sometimes a Republican might get elected and they might not do exactly what we want them to do. So that was, ESG really took off after that. And it seemed to be a response to that. And it is, I think it is political in the sense of trying to do what I would consider to be a political goal through the economy or through the banking system. And so it's like, well, why don't we get banks to, in effect, sort of do this political job? You know, that especially if you see climate change as this existential threat and you think we have to stop using fossil fuels. And if you look at like, oh, well, the government's not going to shut down these fossil fuel companies. We have to do it some other ways. Well, we could shut them down if we can cut them off from access to credit. If we can cut them off from the financial system, you know, then they won't be able to operate. Or if you can cut them off from insurance, if they can't get insurance for to drill oil, well, they're not going to be able to operate. So in some ways, the political part of it is trying to say weaponized business to carry out what should be a function of government. You know, whether it's one party or another, there's certainly a group of, elites or opinion leaders, or I've been reading Thomas Sowell lately, his thoughts on intellectuals. And so this intellectual class or this elite class who all have these, a lot of the same ideas about how they're going to save the world. And that's their main goal in life, is to try to save the world or make the world a better place. And so I think the ESG efforts can be seen as a way to sort of proceed, you know, perhaps I think with the goal of like shutting down fossil fuel production, even if you can't get the government to pass a law saying we're going to shut this down somehow.
It just seems very myopic. At what expense, right? Who benefits and who's really going to get hurt in this? If we move away from fossil fuels, for example, how much is energy going to cost? Can the average person really afford it? What's their life going to be like? I mean, there's no question about that. So you're saying at the beginning of the show that this is still in flux and that we still have some time to work our way out of this system. How can people make the first step What do they need to really be aware of so they can start withdrawing their consent from this type of system?
Well, one of the things that's been happening is a lot of states, especially what we call red states, have been trying to push back in different ways. A number of states have passed anti-ESG bills or different things, one of which would be to command their state pension programs to not invest any funds in ESG funds. Other efforts have been to try to say, discourage or cut banks who are going to do ESG off from state business. And so I think some states are coming up with some innovative solutions, or at least there are attempts to address the problem. Whether they're going to work or not is a different question. I think some of them are at least well-considered attempts to try to do something. And so I think that's probably the most promising thing, because you could talk to your state representative. A lot easier to talk, talk to a state representative, because they have lots of meetings, community meetings in the community. They sure know about this and make sure that they know about these issues. Whether it's ESG or a central bank digital currency or DEI initiatives, and make it clear to them that you, as one of their constituents, care deeply about these issues, and you want to know what they're doing to help protect our interests. Because states have been trying to push back some against these measures, and I think that's an important first start.
I think that you're right, and I question some of these leaders. Like, we live in Georgia, and our governor went to Davos, and I think is all in on the digital scene. Right, they're talking about doing digital IDs for driver's license. I mean, so I get going to your government officials, but I'm a little dubious, honestly, about who they're listening to. They always listen to who's buttering their bread, essentially. Is there something that we can do that doesn't involve going to anybody asking for help? Something that we ourselves can take the lead on, that we don't need anybody else to do for us?
Yeah, let me think. Well, for one thing, if you do have money that you have invested, make sure you take a look at those handouts, the things that they mail to you about exactly how they're running that money. Make sure that you don't have your money invested in a fund or with a company where they're pursuing this if this isn't what you're interested in. So, I mean, you're starting to see some of that too, with people pulling their money out of these ESG funds in the last year, or at least the first part of 2023. Here, we actually saw the amount of money in ESG funds go down for the first time. That would be one thing. Make sure that you're not looking at your investments. Yeah, and then also, if you run a business, maybe talk to your bank. It's probably likely the case that more local banks are going to be less vulnerable to ESG mandates than the bigger banks. So if there's a strong community bank in your community, you want to go there. I know there's this group called the 1792 Exchange that has come up with ratings of this is like Wolf's ratings of corporations, and so you could look and look up their ratings for the company, and for instance, they have a whole bunch of banks rated there, and try to see if you can find one that's not a high risk of violating your funds. So, I mean, there are some things you can do. Like that was the 1792 Exchange. If you're interested in looking at that, they came out with a corporate report to go on this.
That's good to know, and I think also being able to figure out, really know the list of ESG related companies. Is that same organization, do they list companies that are into ESG?
Yeah, it wasn't ESG per se, but they had about, if I recall, about six different areas where they were rating companies. So, do they, are their employees at risk for some kind of this is much like, would you be at risk as an employee to being disciplined if you expressed the wrong sentiment or you're working there? Would you be, are they policing their suppliers, or are they cutting off, if they're a financial institution, are they cutting off, are they debanking customers who are in the wrong business? So it wasn't like ESG per se, but it was measuring some of this risk to customers or people that are doing business with these companies, whether it be, again, as an employee, customer, a supplier, or so forth.
Okay. And from a consumer standpoint, you know, we're seeing a lot of companies be boycotted because people are not for what they're trying to espouse. Is there value in withdrawing your pocketbook, you know, not spending money with these companies, not doing business as an individual with these companies?
There is, and it's as an economist, especially as a free market economist, there's a part of me want to say, well, what it really comes down to is you're buying a good or a service, and if they're doing, they're providing a good service, you know, you buy the best product for the best price. But you know, I think there is some discussion now, perhaps we have to think a little bit more than that, especially, you know, if a company's going to take their profits that they're going to make from selling you this good product, and then like make big donations to groups that are trying to undermine your way of life, there becomes at some point a legitimate question to ask: is buying the best product really in your best interest overall as a person? Certainly, it's in your narrow interest as a consumer, but may not be in your best interest overall. Another thing, if you do choose to boycott, one of the things to do is like, somebody was just telling me this the other day, it's like, if you're unhappy, say with McDonald's, make sure you go in and try to talk to the person who owns your local McDonald's franchise, because that person's probably in your community. The McDonald's doesn't own all those franchises, and make sure if you're going to stop doing business, if you're going to stop going to McDonald's, make sure you let that person know why you're not going to take your family to McDonald's anymore. Because, if you or I try to contact McDonald's, they're probably not going to pay any attention to them. But they will pay attention to their franchisees. And if their franchisees start hearing stuff, and then they go back to corporation, if the franchisees are hearing that from their customers, and they start going to the corporation, then they'll start to hear that.
That's a really good point. I think it's about really letting your voice be heard. I think we are a little bit too removed from, it's just this, they'll do whatever we want because we have the power. But unless we really exert our power, yes, you can withdraw your consent, but I think you're right. They need to know why. And that puts a face on it, that puts more urgency on it, because it's really, they need us. Nothing can exist without the consumer, whether it's a patient, you know, a doctor. Yeah. Everything just depends on us using their services, and they need to know why we stopped doing it. I think you're absolutely right. But there's a silver lining in this, isn't there? If people stop going corporate and they start going local and they know their neighbor and they're going to their place of business and they're with mindfulness using the small business side of this, whether it's farming, going to your local markets, really just shopping with people who you can look at in the face and know that you guys are helping each other. Is that one way around this?
It can be. I think, because at some level, I think all of the really big corporations are going to be highly, highly vulnerable to ESG-type pressures. Because first off, they're likely hiring from all these elite schools, and everybody running those corporations are going to completely think that's the thing you've got to do. And then they're also vulnerable to influence from these companies like BlackRock that are trying to put, they're going to be the first ones to get regulated.
That's
so I think that is something to keep in mind.
You know, time goes way too quickly. I think it was just We had so much information to cover, and I'm really happy you were able to just put it out there in such a clear, concise manner. I'd love to have you come back because I do want to cover regulations, because now if they get what they want, you know, always it seems to me that when they're able, they think they've won, whoever it is, if it's a bigger picture, they're just pawns in this as well. And they're going to end up feeling the heat, so to speak. So I'd love to have you come back to talk about the regulation side.
We have more power than we might sometimes think we have.
Agreed. We only have a few seconds left. I want to make sure people know how to read your blogs and how to watch your television show.
For the television show, just search eConversations, Troy Trojan Vision, and that will get you the YouTube playlist. It's on 1819news.com and then yellowhammernews.com.
Dr. Sutter, you're an amazing guest. I really enjoyed our conversation. I want to thank you again for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm pleased to come on to do this.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.